The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated January 22, 2024. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block lettering. It's in a pale blue, gray, white, superimposed upon a dark blue background. The figure whose image appears on the cover is Secretary of State Antony Blinken, A-N-T-O-N-Y-B-L-I-N-K-E-N. And the caption on the cover is "The Envoy, Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the Test of American Leadership" by Vera Bergengruen. That will be the lead article that I will read. Antony Blinken's head only is in this full-page front cover shot. One sees the shoulders of a dark blue suit coat and a white shirt collar. He has gray hair, silvery gray hair. However, the back of his head blends into that darker background. He has brown eyes. He's looking at an angle, not directly at the camera, but somewhat askance from the camera. He's clean-shaven. He's neither smiling nor frowning. Beginning then with Time Ideas of the Year, the first listed being Antony Blinken and America's Challenge. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the Test of U.S. Power. Under the heading Ideas of the Year, Can America Lead? This is by Vera Bergengruen. It was 2:15 a.m., October 16. Benjamin Netanyahu could not figure out how to work the copy machine. Six floors underground in the Tel Aviv bunker, from which Israel's war cabinet was directing its battle against Hamas, Secretary of State Antony Blinken waited to be handed a sheet of paper outlining the results of a nine-hour negotiating session with the Israeli Prime Minister. Even Blinken's sleep-deprived advisors had no idea what the two men had agreed to behind closed doors. Less than 24 hours earlier, Blinken had been in Cairo, preparing to return to Washington after a six-country dash across the Middle East. The visit had started off with a show of U.S. support after the brutal Hamas attack October 7, followed by talks with Arab allies. But as Israel intensified its bombing campaign in Gaza, Blinken decided to make a U-turn. Cut off from water, food, medicine, and fuel, the enclave was spiraling into a humanitarian crisis. Arriving back in Israel, Blinken conveyed to Netanyahu the anger he had heard from regional leaders and urged him to allow aid into Gaza. In a tense meeting, punctuated by an air raid siren, Netanyahu was intractable. Israel would not tolerate one drop of water, not one ounce of fuel across the border, a senior administration official said. As it grew dark, Blinken and his aides followed Netanyahu from the Curia, Israel's version of the Pentagon, to the underground command center. Huddled around two laptops and a mobile printer in a small room with no cell service, the U.S. team traded proposals with the Israeli cabinet next door. Some came back with Netanyahu's hand-scribbled edits. Finally, the Israeli prime minister and America's top diplomat sat down alone. If Israel was going to proceed in its mission to destroy Hamas, it had to allow aid to reach civilians, Blinken told Netanyahu. He also made clear what was hanging in the balance of a visit from President Joe Biden, the prospect of which had leaked to the Israeli media but had yet to be formalized. A visit from Biden represented a critical gesture of support and significant leverage. At 3 a.m., Blinken went in front of the cameras to announce Biden would visit the country in 2 days to reaffirm his ironclad commitment to its security, and that Israel had agreed to allow food and medical supplies to reach civilians in Gaza. 5 days later, the first 20 trucks rolled in. Ultimately, the logic prevailed, Blinken told Time in an interview in his wood-paneled office at the State Department in late December, his voice hoarse after the latest whirlwind trip. Pausing the text here now to engage you in a full-length, full-page photograph by Jared Soares for Time. It is Mr. Blinken, Secretary Blinken, standing in front of dark wood panel doors, but the room is otherwise trimmed in white woodwork with white gilded columns and a sea green background of wall coloring. He is dressed in either a dark charcoal gray or a dark navy blue suit, white shirt, lighter blue tie, the same silvery gray hair and quite a bit of it. Again, he's looking askance from the camera, his hands clasped in front of himself, with the dark eyes and a rather sincere, if not serious, look. Returning to the text, marathon negotiations like these are now the norm for Blinken. Over the past 3 months, the Secretary of State has spearheaded the administration's efforts to persuade Israeli officials to show restraint while publicly backing a war that Gazan officials say has killed more than 22,000 Palestinians. As he lays them out, Blinken's wins seem dwarfed by the scale of the devastation. More than 100 trucks of humanitarian aid entering Gaza in 1 day. The release of 4 American hostages, 4-hour humanitarian pauses. The figures are totally insufficient in terms of what was actually needed, Blinken says, but you have to start somewhere. That is an uncomfortably apt analogy for American power in 2024. Biden promised to restore American leadership on the world stage after the chaos of the Trump years, but his tenure has been as much defined by evidence of its limits, America's disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan, the stalemated war in Ukraine, a century-defining challenge from a rising China, a conflict in Gaza that threatens to ignite a regional conflagration as it divides the Democratic Party and dampens Biden's re-election prospects. The question hanging over it all is whether the U.S. is still capable of steering an increasingly dangerous world. More than anyone else in America besides Biden, it falls to Blinken to supply the answer. In 4 trips to the Middle East since October, the Secretary of State, 61, has held meetings in royal palaces, military headquarters, villas, airport lounges, bomb shelters. Arab leaders have rebuffed his hug, given him history lectures, and kept him waiting overnight. The Israelis have contradicted him publicly. Even officials close to Blinken admit the U.S. position, calling on Israel to do more to protect Palestinian civilians while continuing to tout their support, is becoming untenable. But in interviews with more than a dozen current and former senior U.S. officials and diplomats, most argue the Secretary's even-keeled approach is a reassuring projection of American leadership at a perilous moment. He is the right guy at the right time, says Tom Nides, or Nides, N-I-D-E-S, who served as U.S. ambassador to Israel until July. I have sat in those rooms with him and Bibi. Tony's a nice guy, but don't screw with him. For generations, America's counterparts have simultaneously resented its power and sought it out. Even now, with its credibility dented abroad and its democracy under pressure at home, the U.S. is called by allies to lead on global problems like pandemics, artificial intelligence, and climate change. It is a different world. This is a more multipolar world, says former Secretary of State John Kerry. That means more diplomacy, and Tony is perfectly suited to that. But the world seems intent on testing that proposition, and nowhere more so than in the Middle East. On the morning of October 7, Blinken was awakened at his home in suburban Virginia at 5 a.m. His chief of staff was on the phone. A vicious surprise attack was unfolding in Israel, with thousands of rockets and Hamas fighters breaching the border. Across 30 years in government, Blinken says, I don't think I've seen anything quite like the nature of the atrocities that were committed. 5 days later, Blinken arrived in Tel Aviv carrying a message of staunch support. We will always be there by your side, he promised, standing next to Netanyahu. This must be a moment for moral clarity. The grief and gratitude from the Israelis he met was overwhelming. In meetings with officials, he was shown gruesome photos of victims, one of a baby shot in the head, another of a baby's burned body. A planned 2-day trip stretched into 7. Blinken hopscotched the region, making stops in Jordan, Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Egypt. There could be no more business as usual with Hamas, he told Arab leaders, who agreed to keep open diplomatic channels to prevent escalation. As the U.S. entourage ducked into meetings, security officers wore body armor instead of suits. Air raid sirens sent staffers scurrying into shelters. In the end, Blinken left with a sense the U.S. had accomplished something solid. It is never like flipping a light switch. It is always a process, he says. And there's always a little bit of lag between being there and seeing the actual realization. By his second trip to the region in early November, the mood had shifted. Israel had followed its air campaign with a ground incursion into Gaza. The images of destruction and the rising civilian casualty count were producing mass protests around the world. The Israelis could tell U.S. officials felt the pressure. The strategy was to give as much as possible to the Americans on humanitarian issues, says former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren. The view was that Biden needs time and space because he is constricted by his own party. If that was the approach, it did not always show. Netanyahu defied American requests and contradicted its public positions while flaunting what he called the diplomatic iron dome of U.S. support. We went from being there in commiseration with Israel, supporting a friend in a public outpouring of grief, to having these very difficult conversations and having to push and push and push in a really tough negotiation, says a senior Biden administration official. Blinken and his boss were left with choices that ranged between very bad and worse, says Aaron David Miller, a longtime Middle East advisor to both Republican and Democratic secretaries of state. While Biden has a personal bond with Israel, there's no love lost between him and Netanyahu, who repeatedly undermined the Obama administration. But Biden knows feuding with an Israeli prime minister never turns out well, says Miller. It can be politically costly and is usually counterproductive. Over time, Blinken's public message began to change. He expressed empathy for Palestinian victims and noted the gap between Israel's stated intent of protecting civilians and what was happening on the ground. When I see a Palestinian boy or girl pulled from the wreckage of a building, it hits me in the gut, he said at a November 4 press conference. I see my own children in their faces. The same day, sitting in a white swivel chair at the St. Regis Hotel in Amman, Blinken got an earful from his Arab counterparts, according to a senior administration official. They warned the U.S. was wiping out 30 years of work and giving the impression Israel was above international law. Ayman Safadi, foreign minister of Jordan, one of America's closest regional allies, told him Israel was committing war crimes. If you want to help Israel, by all means help, Safadi said. But you're not helping Israel by not speaking against this mad war. The conflict was becoming a test of American influence and Blinken's. As the face of the U.S. diplomatic effort, the secretary came to shoulder the blame for what critics see as Israel's excesses. On his visit to the West Bank city of Ramallah, demonstrators burned images of his face, crossed out with a red X. Ahead of his arrival in Ankara, a banner over a highway read, "Baby Killer Blinken." For someone used to working behind the scenes, friends say the criticism has taken a toll. It is really, really tough and brutal. The physical toll, the pressure, the public glare, says James Steinberg, the dean of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, who's worked with Blinken for decades. If people do not see that it is changing Israeli behavior, then you bear the brunt of the failure to convey the message. Most nights, Blinken returns home after his two young children's bedtime, so he's made it a priority to have breakfast with them in the morning. December 8th, they were interrupted by protesters outside his house. "Blinken, Blinken, rise and shine," they chanted. "You're committing genocide." The secretary comes from a diplomatic pedigree. His father, Donald Blinken, served as ambassador to Hungary, and his stepfather, Samuel Pisar, was a Polish-born diplomat and lawyer who survived 4 years in Nazi concentration camps as a teenager. After escaping a death march in Bavaria, Pisar was rescued by American soldiers, an event Blinken credits for shaping his worldview. Born in New York City, he largely grew up in Paris, which he says taught him to see America from the outside. He returned to the U.S. to attend Harvard, dabbled in journalism, filmmaking, and law, before joining Bill Clinton's White House, where he worked as a speechwriter and on the National Security Council. In 1995, he met his wife, Evan Ryan, who worked for then First Lady Hillary Clinton and now serves as Biden's White House Cabinet Secretary. Blinken went to work for Biden in 2002 as the Democratic Staff Director of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He served in various roles in the Obama administration, including Deputy Secretary of State. It is difficult to find a photo of Biden at any major moment in foreign policy over the past 20 years without Blinken in the background, wearing matching aviators in Kosovo, crammed into a helicopter in Baghdad, hovering in the back of the iconic Situation Room photo captured during the mission to kill Osama bin Laden. "Tony brings to the job the first and most important thing," says Kerry, which is the confidence of the president. When Blinken took over at State, after 4 years of a Trump presidency that disdained traditional diplomacy, the department was suffering from low morale, steep budget cuts, high attrition. The contrast with Blinken's predecessor, Mike Pompeo, who vowed to restore swagger to State and signed emails, "Keep on crushing it," could not have been starker. "Tony does not swagger," says Barbara Bodine, a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen and a 30-year veteran of the Foreign Service. He does not lead with his ego. Blinken was a departure in other ways. He does not have the military gravitas of Colin Powell, that would be Colin Powell, or the political celebrity of Hillary Clinton or Kerry. In describing his style, three former colleagues invoked former Secretary of State George Shultz's oft-cited analogy, comparing diplomacy to gardening. The way to keep weeds from overwhelming you, Shultz liked to say, is to deal with them constantly and in their early stages. But Shultz was at state during the Cold War. Today's world presents a different set of challenges, which has made the unglamorous work of tending global ties rather than bending nations to Washington's will both more relevant and more challenging. This is what I was instructed to do by the president from day one, says Blinken. This has been for many, many years, in a sense, our secret sauce, something that really is our competitive advantage, our networks of partners and allies, that other countries, notably our adversaries, simply don't have. As the war in Ukraine nears its second anniversary, the conflict has been more a point of concern about U.S. leadership than a reassuring example of it. That's partly due to the administration's challenges at home. Republicans, once staunch hawks, now argue for cutting foreign spending to confront aggression by Vladimir Putin's Russia. We have to keep reminding people, if we allow Putin to move forward with impunity in Ukraine, we would be opening a Pandora's box, Blinken says. Putin wouldn't stop with Ukraine. Blinken, who's met with dissenters and tells Time he reads every memo, acknowledges a broader problem. Our strength at home goes directly to our standing around the world, he says. He also argues the U.S. is stronger than its critics credit. I've found people have seen that we're serious about ourselves, he says, and they want to work with us. Spending more on defense than the next 10 countries combined, the U.S. military remains unmatched. America's economy remains the envy of the world. Yet as Blinken gears up for his fourth trip to the Middle East since October 7, the U.S. faces a growing array of global tests. Iran's proxies have stepped up attacks on U.S. troops and vital shipping lanes of the Red Sea. North Korea's tested new intercontinental ballistic missiles. China's grown more confrontational with U.S. allies in the South China Sea. With a pro-U.S. front runner in the upcoming election in Taiwan, China's leader Xi Jinping recently told Biden it intends to take control of the island. The weeds Blinken is trying to control are sprouting into thickets. Fairly or not, America's ability to navigate the war between Israel and Hamas has become a litmus test of its power. Blinken says bringing the war to an end as quickly as possible will be one of the administration's main priorities in 2024. But Israeli officials insist the operations will last months at least. To some, the gap between what the U.S. wants and what it can deliver is diminishing its credibility. I think we look confused, says former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton. You can tell Israel to go slower, you can tell Israel to go fast, but you cannot tell it to do both at the same time. Blinken, the consummate old-school diplomat, appears unperturbed by the criticism. All we can do is be responsible for the moment we are in, he says, gripping the arm of a chair in his office. We are trying to put in place a foundation that's durable and lasting, irrespective of who happens to be in office. From his window, the Secretary of State has a view of the Lincoln Memorial, a temple erected in tribute to a president who led during a period of rupture in the Republic. As Blinken spoke, a cleaning crew was scrubbing a message splashed in bright red paint over its marble steps. The words were still visible. Free Gaza. That was slightly abridged. The article was written by Vera Bergen-Gruen with reporting by Eric Cortalesa. Here is a shorter article, Choose Your Stories Well, by Tom Rivett-Carnac and Oliver Jeffers. Rivett-Carnac is a member of the Time CO2 Advisory Council, an environmental strategist and podcaster. Jeffers is an artist and writer. So often, articles and essays such as this begin with a gathering of unnerving statistics. Most of us do not need those anymore. Changes brought about by the climate crisis are becoming more tangible with the passing of each year. We smell it in the smoke-tinged air. We feel it in the seasons gone askew. We exist in a place where all the problems of the universe are present, and the problems we have today really can seem insurmountable, too vast for any of us to do anything about. But that's just it. We think only of the inadequacy of what we alone can do. This is partly because, over the past several generations, we have been taught to think of ourselves as individuals, pitted against one another, to take what we can, while we can. But if we believe staving off catastrophe is futile, that belief infuses our thinking, paralyzing our decisions. Conversely, the opposite is true. If our mindset shifts toward the realization that we, having invented all of the ways we go about modern life, can change those systems, we would arguably make a sustainable future more likely. In other words, if we think we can't, or think we can, we are right. And we can. Because alongside all the problems that exist only here on Earth, there also sit, conveniently, all the solutions we need. While so many of us argue about whose version of the climate story is right, others are just quietly problem-solving the myriad issues we face in practical terms, one by one. There are hundreds, thousands, millions of brave individuals, communities, companies and activists already shaping a regenerative future, getting out of the way of their own egos. Perhaps you are one of them. These are the people with the glint in their eyes and the seductive calls to action, because they are already taking it. If we root our display in climate, our despair in climate change, then we must root our hopes in its solutions. It is time to intentionally put our efforts into creating and sharing stories of what is possible, stories that bring out the most extraordinary aspects of humanity, compassion, kindness, ingenuity, creativity. These are the stories we can choose to tell, and we must choose to tell them together. The View. Subtitled The World, subtitled The Top Risks of 2024 by Ian Bremmer. Each year, this risk report forecast predicts what the world should watch out for in the coming months. In 2023, the big story centered on wars in Europe and the Middle East, and those conflicts will expand in 2024. But it's a third war, the U.S. versus itself, that poses the greatest global risk. And as always, there will be new stories that deserve more attention than they are getting. One. There are going to be 10 of them here. One, the U.S. versus itself. While America's military and economy remain exceptionally strong, the U.S. political system is more dysfunctional than any other advanced industrial democracy. In 2024, the problem will get much worse. The presidential election will deepen the country's political division, testing American democracy to a degree the nation has not experienced in 150 years, and undermining U.S. credibility internationally. With the outcome of the vote, close to a coin toss, at least for now. The only certainty is damage to America's social fabric, political institutions, and international standing. In a world beset by crises, the prospect of a Trump victory will weaken America's position on the global stage as Republican lawmakers take up his foreign policy positions and U.S. allies and adversaries hedge against his likely policies. Number two, Middle East on the brink. The fighting in Gaza will expand in 2024, with several pathways for escalation into a broader regional war. Some could draw the U.S. and Iran more directly into the fighting. The conflict will pose risks to the global economy, widen geopolitical and political divisions, and stroke global extremism. The straightest route to intensification would be a decision by either Israel or Hezbollah to attack the other. Top Israeli leaders have pledged to remove the threat from Hezbollah. If Israel were to attack preemptively, the U.S. military would provide support, and Iran would assist Hezbollah, its most important regional proxy. Houthi militants are also pursuing an escalatory path, and Shiite militias operating in Iraq and Syria have increased attacks on U.S. bases, undoubtedly with Tehran's blessing. No country involved in the Gaza conflict wants a regional conflict to erupt, but the powder's dry, and the number of players carrying matches makes the risk of escalation high. Number three, partitioned Ukraine. Russia's invasion of Ukraine remains a historic failure. NATO is strengthened by new members, Finland and Sweden. The EU has opened a membership process for Ukraine. Russia has faced 11 rounds of sanctions, with more on the way, and half of its sovereign assets have been frozen, money increasingly likely to be used for Ukrainian reconstruction. Europe no longer buys Russian energy, but Ukraine will be de facto partitioned this year, and Russia now has the battlefield initiative and a material advantage. This year will be an inflection point in the war, and if Ukraine does not solve its manpower problems, increase weapons production, and set a realistic military strategy soon, its territorial losses could prove permanent and may well expand. Kyiv has taken a body blow on continued military help from the U.S., and the outlook for European assistance is only slightly better. Ukraine's desperate for more troops. For all these reasons, Kyiv will take bigger military risks this year, including with strikes on more targets inside Russia that provoke unprecedented Russian responses and could pull NATO into the conflict. Number four, ungoverned AI. Technology will outstrip AI governance in 2024 as regulatory efforts falter. Tech companies remain largely unconstrained, and far more powerful AI models and tools spread beyond the control of governments. Number five, Axis of Rogues and America's Dangerous Friends. In 2024, Russia, North Korea, and Iran will boost one another's capabilities and act in increasingly coordinated and disruptive ways on the global stage. In Russia's case, even an unlikely early end to the war will not end its political and economic isolation from the West. Meanwhile, Washington faces higher risk that Ukraine, Israel, and even Taiwan can pull the U.S. into confrontations it wants to avoid. 6. No China Recovery. Beijing's failure to reform the country's sputtering economy growth model, the country's financial fragilities, and a crisis of public confidence will expose gaps in the Chinese Communist Party's leadership capabilities and weigh on global growth. In addition, President Xi Jinping's stranglehold on power and a prioritization of national security over economic concerns will weigh on consumer, business, and investor confidence. It will also leave his regime prone to underestimate economic and financial vulnerabilities and to overestimate its capacity to address them. Number 7, the fight for critical minerals. Certain minerals will be a crucial component in virtually every sector that will drive growth, innovation, and national security in the 21st century. From clean energy to advanced computing, biotechnology, transportation, and defense. In 2024, governments around the world will take protectionist measures that disrupt the flow of the critical minerals needed for advanced, large-scale technological progress. I'll stop here and read to you the caption of a photo. It spans 2 pages, but it isn't 2 pages in volume. It's more like 2/3 of a page. Trucks prepare to transport chromium ore in Odisha, India. This is a square of dark blue with minor gradations into even darker blue or lighter blue. And in the lower left-hand corner, one sees about 10 lights, their headlights on large ore-bearing trucks with a huge lantern at the end of the road. This is some kind of an ore mine in India. Returning now to the enumerated paragraphs. Number 8, no room for error. The global inflation shock that began in 2021 will continue to exert an economic and political drag in 2024. Higher for longer interest rates caused by stubborn inflation will slow growth around the world, and governments will have little scope to stimulate growth or respond to shocks, heightening risk of financial stress, social unrest, and political instability. 9. El Niño. After a 4-year absence, a powerful El Niño climate pattern will peak in the first half of this year, bringing extreme weather events that trigger food insecurity, increase water stress, disrupt logistics, spread disease, and foment migration and political instability, particularly in countries already weakened by the pandemic and the energy and food price shocks created by the Ukraine war. Number 10, risky business. Customers, employees, investors, mostly on the progressive side, have brought the U.S. culture wars to corporate offices. And now courts, state legislatures, activist groups, mostly conservative ones, will hit back. Companies caught in the political and legal crossfire will face higher costs and confusion over their communications strategies. Those were the 10 items, but another paragraph follows entitled Red Herrings. This will be another turbulent year for U.S.-China relations, particularly over Taiwan and tech competition. But domestic preoccupations have persuaded President Joe Biden and Xi Jinping that better managed relations serve both sides. Europe's populists will continue to strike fear in the establishment, but limited setbacks for mainstream parties at European Parliament, national, and local elections will neither upend the European political order nor derail EU ambitions rejuvenated by the COVID-19 pandemic and Ukraine war. Even after this year's expansion, the BRICS will not emerge as a China-led rival to the G7. Ian Bremmer wrote this article and Bremer is a foreign affairs columnist and editor-at-large at Time, and the president of Eurasia Group and G-Zero, G-Z-E-R-O, Media. Here's the view, Health. It's nearly a page in length. It's subcaptioned, Role Models, Pigs, Squirrels, and Managing Pain, by David Agus, A-G-U-S, who is an M.D. and is author of The Book of Animal Secrets, from which this article is adapted. In the upper right-hand corner is a very sunny photograph. It's not a large photograph, but it's in color, with a bright blue sky, lots of green and yellow grasses, green copse of either trees or large shrubs, and a mud hole. And in the mud hole, about half submerged, is a pig, a pink and white pig. And the caption reads, a domestic pig bathing in a mud hole. I think it's really sunbathing. Its eyes are closed as if it's just in a lackadaisical mood in that mud hole. Over the past several decades, there have been many supporting studies of the health-promoting effects of an optimistic personality. Newer research demonstrates high levels of hope have been found to be related to lower levels of pain, psychological distress, and functional disability in patients with chronic illnesses. This is not to say there's no value in grief and feeling glum. Forced optimism can backfire when too much inauthentic positivity leads to denialism and hiding dark emotions that demand we process them. But the two do interact to help determine your overall personality and approach to life in response to positive or negative events. Unsurprisingly, this is also true for other members of the animal kingdom, particularly for pigs and squirrels. In fact, the domestic pig is an interesting animal to study and compare with humans in terms of the way it processes happiness and pain. Pigs are among a growing list of research subjects in the relatively young scientific field of animal personality. They share a number of cognitive capacities with humans, such as self-awareness, experiencing emotions, and playfulness. Studies on the domestic pig tell us mood and personality interact to influence thinking and how our biases come into play with our environment. And therein lies a key word, environment. It turns out that environment can make or break our moods, and those of pigs. In pigs, personality is frequently measured by watching how the animals cope under different circumstances. Pigs that are deemed proactive, characterized by more active and consistent behavior, are not the same as reactive pigs that behave more passively and erratically. According to one illuminating 2016 study by researchers in the UK, reactive pigs living in a feel-good environment, like a roomier, straw-filled pen, were much more likely to be optimistic if they were given an obstacle to deal with that was not routine, like a feeding bowl with an unknown ingredient inside. Proactive pigs, in contrast, were likely to respond optimistically in such situations, even if they lived in a smaller, more barren environment. In studies on humans, proactivity and reactivity have been linked to extroversion and neuroticism, respectively, with extroverts more optimistic and those with neurotic tendencies more pessimistic. Our personalities color our decisions, and our moods can be influenced by our environments, which means we do have some control in protecting our preferred moods. If you want to tip the scales in favor of being hopeful and reap the health rewards, you need to be mindful of your living quarters, what, and most definitely whom, you surround yourself with, and where you spend your leisure time. A study published in 2021 from the University of California, Davis, and the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory in Colorado was the first to document personality in golden-mantled ground squirrels, common across the western U.S. The researchers recorded four main traits: boldness, aggressiveness, activity level, and sociability. They noted that more gregarious squirrels move quicker, command the use of more space and places to perch themselves, and gain more access to resources. These effects ultimately favor the social squirrel's survival. It pays to be convivial and maybe a little brash. Although pain and pain management within the context of personality was not part of the study, we can draw some conclusions nevertheless. There's a lot that each of us has control over, and many things, like health, where we have only partial control. So we have to use the power we have to tip the scales in our favor. This means taking a good look at our lifestyles, our moods, our environments, whom we associate with, where we choose to spend our time. Maybe it will not alleviate all our symptoms, but it will have a major influence. This next lengthy article will be abridged. It's called Origin Story by Simon Schuster. It's under the heading World. The Ukrainian president's formative years in his hard-bitten hometown and post-Soviet Moscow. Volodymyr Zelensky was already a celebrity when his first child was born in 2004. Back then, he and his wife Olena Zelenska often lived apart. He spent his days touring and promoting his comedy troupe in Kyiv, while she often stayed with her parents in their hometown of Kryvyi Rih, the city that Zelensky would later credit with forging his character. "My big soul, my big heart," he once called it. "Everything I have, I got from there." The name of the town translates as Crooked Horn, and in conversation, Zelensky and his wife tend to refer to it in Russian as Krivoy, the crooked place, where both of them were born in the winter of 1978, about 2 weeks apart. Few, if any, places in Ukraine had a worse reputation in those years for violence and urban decay. The main employer in the city was the metallurgical plant, whose gargantuan blast furnaces churned out more hot steel than any other facility in the Soviet Union. During World War II, the plant was leveled by the Luftwaffe as the Nazis began their occupation of Ukraine. It was rebuilt in the 1950s and 60s, and many thousands of veterans went to work there. So did convicts released from Soviet labor camps. Most of them settled into blocks of industrial housing, hives of reinforced concrete that offered almost nothing in the way of leisure, culture, or self-development. There were not nearly enough theaters, gyms, or sports facilities to occupy the local kids. By the late 1980s, when the population peaked at over 750,000, the city devolved into what Zelensky would later describe as a banditsky gorod, a city of bandits. Olena remembers it more fondly than that. "It was not full of bandits in my eyes," she told me. "Maybe boys and girls run in different circles when they're growing up, but yes, it is true. There was a period in the 90s when there was a lot of crime, especially among young people. There were gangs. The boys who joined these gangs, mostly teenagers, were known as beguni, literally runners, because groups of them would run through the streets, beating and stabbing their rivals, flipping over cars, smashing windows. Some of the gangs were known for using homemade explosives and improvised firearms, which they learned to fashion out of metal pipes stuffed with gunpowder and fish hooks. Some of them got killed," Olena said. According to local news reports, the death toll reached into the dozens by the mid-1990s. Many more runners were maimed beaten with clubs or blinded with shrapnel from their homemade bombs. Every neighborhood was in on it, the First Lady said. When kids of a certain age wandered into the wrong neighborhood, they could run up against a question. What part of town you from? Then the problems could start. It was nearly impossible, she said, for teenage boys to avoid joining one of the gangs. You could even be walking home in your own part of town, and they'd come up and ask what gang you're with. What are you doing here? Just being on your own was scary. It was not done. The gangs had their heyday in the late 1980s, when there were dozens of them around the city, with thousands of runners in all. Many of those who survived into the 1990s graduated into organized crime, which flourished in Kyiv-Ri during the sudden transition from communism to capitalism. Parts of the city turned into wastelands of racketeers and alcoholics. But Zelensky, thanks in large part to his family, avoided the pull of the streets. His paternal grandfather, Semyon Zelensky, served as a senior officer in the city's police force, investigating organized crime, or as his grandson later put it, catching bad guys. Stories of his service in the Second World War made a profound impression on the young Zelensky, as did the traumas of the Holocaust. Both sides of his family are Jewish, and they lost many of their own during the war. His mother's side of the family survived in large part because they were evacuated to Central Asia as the German occupation began in 1941. The following year, when he was still a teenager, Semyon Zelensky went to fight in the Red Army and wound up in command of a mortar platoon. All three of his brothers fought in the war, and none of them survived. Neither did their parents, Zelensky's great-grandparents, who were killed during the Nazi occupation of Ukraine, along with over a million other Ukrainian Jews, in what became known as the Holocaust by Bullets. Around their kitchen table, Zelensky's relatives often brought up these tragedies and the crimes of the German occupiers, but little was ever said about the torments that Joseph Stalin inflicted on Ukraine. As a child, Zelensky remembers his grandmother's talking in vague terms about the years when Soviet soldiers came to confiscate the food grown in Ukraine, its vast harvests of grain and wheat all carted away at gunpoint. It was part of Stalin's attempt in the early 1930s to remake Soviet society, and it led to a catastrophic famine known as the Holodomor, murder by hunger, that killed at least 3 million people in Ukraine. In Soviet schools, the topic was taboo, including the schools where both of Zelensky's grandmothers worked as teachers. One taught the Ukrainian language, the other taught Russian. When it came to the famine, Zelensky said they talked about it very carefully, that there was this period when the state took away everything, all the food. Zelensky was the product of an era of change. He was too young to experience the Soviet Union as the stagnant, repressive gerontocracy his parents had known. By the time he returned to Ukraine with his mother, the stage was set for the empire's collapse. Moscow was broke. Its grand experiment in socialism had failed. Mikhail Gorbachev, the reluctant reformer with the soft southern accent, had already begun his doomed attempts to reform the system without breaking it apart. Even for someone Zelensky's age, these changes were hard to miss. He could see them in empty grocery shelves, the endless lines for basic goods like sausage and toilet paper, and he saw them clear as day on television. Under Gorbachev, the censors on Soviet TV became a lot more permissive, reflecting the wider push to relax the state's control over the media. One of the most popular TV shows of the era was known as KVN, which stands for The Club of the Funny and Inventive. It was a comedy show, but not the kind most people in the U.S. and Europe would associate with that term. This was not the stand-up of Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy. There was no minimalism here, no lonely cynic at the microphone breaking taboos. KVN was more like a sports league for young comedians. It involved competing troupes of performers, often made up of college students, doing sketch acts and improv in front of a panel of judges who decided at the end of the show which team was the funniest. Without a doubt, his father said years later, we advised him to do something different, and we thought the interest in KVN was temporary, that he would change, that he would choose a profession. After all, he is a lawyer. He finished our institute. Indeed, Jelinski had completed his studies and earned a law degree while performing in KVN, but he had no intention of practicing law. He found it boring. He got back to home to Ukraine. Jelinski and his friends staged a series of weddings in their hometown of Kryvyi Rih, 3 Saturdays in a row. Olena Kiyashko married Volodymyr Jelinski September 6, 2003. And Pikalov and Pereverez married their respective girlfriends. By the end of the year, when Olena was pregnant with their daughter, Jelinski moved to Kyiv to build up his new production company, Studio Kvartal 95. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.